Okay, welcome back, and we're going to spend some time with a man I call America's most heroic citizen, patriot scientist, Clifford Carnicom, whose work with chemtrails, of course, is and will remain world famous for as long as there are people still walking around with at least a modicum of freedom of speech and freedom of thought. And, of course, that would include the fact that they would have to be relatively aluminum and barium free to engage in those practices, because the stuff they're dropping on us is not friendly. Clifford lately has been turning his attention to that most mysterious and ugly disorder, affliction, syndrome. I hesitate to call it a disease because it's very likely not caused by a typical disease organism as we understand and know them. There's something else, something much more sinister and mysterious at work. We're going to be doing another program in maybe about a week or so and bring us up to date from another angle of this bizarre situation called Morgellons. Clifford Carnicom, are you there?
Oh, I sure am, Jeff. Greetings and thanks again very much.
Sure. Oh, of course. Well, thanks for doing everything you do. I don't know how you do it, but I know we would be literally in the dark ages without your work in terms of chemtrails and now what you're doing with Morgellons. You're probing and pushing into areas that I'm sure that various individuals and what we call loosely the government are not happy about. But to hell with them and onward, as they say. So tell us what's new and where we're going.
Yeah, that's right, Jeff. And I wanted to thank you in return also because, you know, as we've looked through the years, you know, this is a place, speaking with you, where I know that from the very beginning, same thing, that you had no hesitation of confronting the issue and have a willingness to discuss it from the absolute beginning. And I thank you equally in return for providing that platform, and that's why I very much choose to speak with you.
Thank you.
And I value your commentary along the way very much.
Thank you. Well, I'm honored to be able to do it. And there are a lot of very intelligent people out there waiting to hear what you've come up with next. Are the results beginning to cascade now? You've put in the groundwork. What's happening?
You know, I would say that certainly there is an accumulation. I mean, the research is of that form. If the research is consistent, hopefully over time it creates a pattern, a base of information that, mm-hmm. that helps us understand a more comprehensive picture as a whole.
Right.
And hopefully we're making some progress that way. I thought in terms of a rough outline so the audience would have an idea what to expect. I'd briefly give an idea of the layout of the schedule we have us
very good.
Between us and then go on from there. I thought I'd take the first hour and catch up with some papers that they didn't exist when we spoke. I see that we spoke back in November of last year, and we made a reference to several papers that were forthcoming. Mm-hmm. Probably three or four, and we covered
right.
the general intent of those papers very briefly and quickly. Those papers now exist. There's probably three or four of them, and I'd like to sort of summarize those papers to catch up with what we were talking about at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the last hour or so, shift towards two papers of pretty strong substance, I think. That do look at things from a more comprehensive sense, I think, in terms of what we're dealing with. And before we even did that, you know, I thought I would take a second and just, you know, it's nice to reflect sometimes and understand where we are. And I thought I'd take a second and answer the question which I was asking myself is, you know, why did I actually enter into this aspect of the research on Morgellons? You know, how did that happen? And we know that my work started in the aerosol side of things, 1999, beginning of 1999. We're up to 11 years now. And the first reference that I made to an issue which caught my attention on this was back in 2003
mm-hmm.
on my side. And then the actual first paper I wrote relative to the Morgellons issue was back in 2006. So, you know, we're already talking 5 to 6 year period.
Wow.
Out of that 11 year period
mm-hmm.
where there was something about this issue that let's say, was worthy of our attention some time ago. And what it was, I think there's two main parts of it that caught my attention. And the first was the way that the issue was handled in the public arena. Namely, that you had an issue where something serious was happening in the same way that you had, the physical reality, direct observation, and thousands and thousands of people getting involved on the aerosol side, meaning the environment was changing. Now you had a health issue where, again, you had like people with physical things going on,
mm-hmm.
and they were reporting this, and the issue is ridiculed and denied. And the similarity of pattern is that in the aerosol issue, everybody is told, everything is just normal. Don't worry about anything. When the Morgellons issue arises on the scene,
right.
They can't exactly say it's normal because it's highly abnormal what was being reported. So they introduced the term delusional, right? They characterize people as being crazy. So on one side, they're saying, everything's normal, everything's fine. In the other side, the strategies and tactics of marginalization and ridicule are the same in both cases.
We might
now
also
they need to call the people delusional.
Yeah, that's called DOP. We might want to mention also, Clifford, for our tens, if not hundreds of thousands of veterans out there who have very serious psychological, neurological, and physical problems who are being given the same delusional diagnosis by the VA, which is an outrage by any measure.
And when you're dealing with something that is physical, all right, it's a little bit risky to take in that tactic, but, under the programming side of propaganda and programming, we're at the stage where you can basically put in any agenda you want out there, and that's the one that was chosen. The other reason that I was drawn into this issue was because of the similarity in physical form from the very beginning. In other words, in the aerosol issue, you had the appearance of a very, very unusual filament structure, really just about from the onset, and it's
sure.
The EPA gets involved.
Right.
And then in the Morgellons issue, you have the same type of form going on. You have an unusual filament that no one is willing to acknowledge or address properly, and yet physically you have it. So, these were the two reasons, I think, that I saw, let's call it, some level of association between these situations and
sure.
why they were deserving and worthy. And, as I look back, we have 5 to 6 years, and the overlap, as we've gone along, actually has become stronger and stronger more, I think, than people even realize. So with that being said, in terms of the underlying connection in terms of the way the issue was handled in the public, let's go on into these papers that we talked about last time, where we spoke of the issue, but
sure.
the papers weren't written. And there's three or four papers. One of them is called A Mechanism of Blood Damage. One of them is called, it's about pH and conductivity, and I want to focus on the live analysis part of it. And another one is on animal blood, and another is on the what I call an environmental source. And, I said I might not have time for this environmental source paper, but, truthfully, that paper really deserves to be talked about. So I'm going to do my best to give a highlight at least on each of these, and maybe some I'll get through very quickly, and I think we'll have plenty of time.
Okay, very good.
To finish them. But
by the way, Clifford's latest offering is up at Rents.com as well, right below his name and guests. It's called Morgellons, A Discovery and a Proposal.
Yes, thank you, Jeff. The first paper that I'd like to bring up is this paper called A Mechanism of Blood Damage. Oh, and you know what? Before we do this, as I was saying in your notes, why don't I outline the physical nature of what I'm finding over and over and over and over, year after year now?
Please do, because that kind of consistency is bedrock to a lot of people who may be open-minded but unsure, and that's crucial.
Yeah, and then, as we go along here tonight, I'll keep referring to these things, and I think it can get a bit confusing. I mean, I have a pretty intimate, let's say, acquaintance and knowledge with these things, and it gets a little tricky, I'm thinking, from the outside to envision them. But before we go into these papers, there are four, call them structures, call them entities, call them potential organisms, whatever you want to call them, but four things that are being found.
All right, very good. Stand by right there, Clifford, if you would.
Yeah.
We'll come right back and name those four things as we set the stage for our conversation tonight with Clifford Carnicom, one of the truly great Americans of our time. Be right back. Okay, let's get right back to Clifford Carnicom. All right, Clifford, please, let's lay out those four items of groundwork on the table and proceed.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. With respect to the Morgellons condition, there are four structures or entities that I am identifying over and over and over from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
There may be others, but this is what I have access to with the equipment that I can see.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts with the filament. This is the obvious one that caught people's attention to begin with. And, you know, this became present on the skin.
Also known as fiber.
Yes. And this particular structure at this level is visible to the eye. And with what I'm seeing right now in the culturing work, which we'll talk about later, at this point, this represents the culmination of the development stage that I can see. I see probably four stages of this also altogether. And the filament is the culminating structure from the best I can see. Now, the size of this is roughly, generally, seems on the order of 12 to 20 microns. This is something that can be seen by eye. Human hair is roughly 60 to 100 microns. So you can pick this up by eye. And then inside of this filament, and I'm still regarding this as just one structure right now, but inside of this you can have a sub-micron filament structure.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great deal of similarity there with the airborne environmental samples that got tied in with the EPA, and that was my reference to the similarity in form at the beginning that caught my attention. So this is one, a bounding or an encasing filament, which encases frequently or often a submicron filament network. Number two and three are both what I would call in the bacterial-like. I need to and continue to use the word phrase like, because we don't have the absolute positive identification that we need. But in terms of what these appear to be closest to in terms of form and life, assuming it is a regular living organism, is of the bacterial class. And so I call them bacterial-like. And there are two of these. One of them is circular in form. Roughly, best I can come up with is roughly a half a micron in diameter, somewhere in there, anywhere from 0.5 to 0.8 tenths of a micron.
Mm-hmm.
Not normally accessible with, you know, visible light microscopy. We've talked about that in the past, but, you know, I'm up to about 10,000 max, and I can pick these things up at that level. You would probably just see it at about 5,000. But it's beyond the limit of conventional microscopy. So if we have to think about the normal world getting access to this information, it's not going to happen without access to electron microscopes or somebody that's in the right world or high-quality digital equipment, that type of thing, but certainly not conventional microscopy. So the first is this bacterial form, which I call chlamydia-like. This is the best I can come up with in terms of its characteristics, size, and its life cycle, this type of thing, and specifically chlamydia pneumonia. And I'm not saying it is chlamydia pneumonia. In fact, if you read my papers, as we'll talk about later tonight, it doesn't fit entirely. But it's the closest that I can come up with. The third is what I call pleomorphic form. Again, the strongest candidate here in terms of what it seems to match most closely in our world that we're familiar with is mycoplasma. Mycoplasma by itself is too small. They're about 0.2 of a micron from one another. They're apparently the smallest bacteria that there is without a cell wall. And in fact, because they don't have a cell wall, that's what allows them to assume different forms. And this is where the word pleomorphic comes from. Right. And so what I'm seeing, I believe, is a growth, basically, of that organism, which manifests. And if you look at the colony forms of mycoplasma, you will see it match, again, as close as I can to anything I can find. Several pictures is the best I can come up with.
Two-tenths of a micron.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Two-tenths of a micron puts us down, just for our listeners, into the area of viruses.
That's right. It's right in that transition zone. And so I can't actually, I've had a hint of it, actually. I can tell there's something there, but I just don't have the resolution to pick it up. But the later growth of it, of a mycoplasma colony, is something that's visible. They actually, you know, they can become visible by eye eventually. So this would be the third one. And those number two and three, both of those are bacterial-like. And then the last one, I can use the word erythrocytic is what I'm using. Again, we don't know exactly, but let's just say it has a match across in all ways, size, shape, you know, biconcavity to an erythrocyte or a red blood cell. The part that gets very strange about it is there are some tests that indicate a very strong likelihood of an artificially developed erythrocyte because of some very perfect geometry that showed up within a set of tests, as well as an increase in size in one certain test, almost like the conditions of reconstitution were absolutely ideal, and they came to be even a little bit larger in size.
So what you're saying is that these what appear to be red blood cells are almost too perfect to have just, they don't look natural, they're too perfect, and some of them look like an erythrocyte on steroids. They're huge.
I have a whole paper. Again, we just sort of run out of time and topics, but I have a whole paper. The title of it is called Artificial Blood with a question mark after it. There's a whole paper in depth that shows that whole reconstitution process, their association with the filaments and this type of thing. Remember that this filament, that bounding filament that I'm speaking of, eventually is encasing all of these structures that I'm talking about. So, you know, if we wanted a single package where all of these things are, the encasing filament would have it. But yes, that paper is rather remarkable to me in terms of what it shows. It indicates a very strong likelihood that, you know, that was an artificial development or something.
Wow. So as we go to break here, the filament itself may be partially a carrier mechanism. This is wild. Quite a gift basket from hell. Each and every one of them, perhaps. This is quite startling. Be right back with Clifford in just a few minutes. Okay, welcome back. Clifford Carnicom is my guest tonight, and we're looking over his shoulder at some of his extraordinary scientific research into Morgellons, and we've already touched upon the interesting associative value and nature between Morgellons and its symptoms and the aerosol poisoning, which we've been all suffering from for, 15 years now anyway. Go ahead, Clifford, please.
Yes, thanks a lot, Jeff. And, you know, please feel free to ask any questions. And if I don't cover something properly, please interrupt me and make sure we do, because, you know, this whole show, it's for the audience, and so if we don't communicate what we need, then you help me out. But
will do.
We have these four structures that are identified, and the next thing I would mention is that there appears to be a logical, I wouldn't call it logical necessarily, but a progression, at least, certainly a sequential progression of growth through those four stages. And if there is a progression to be identified, the best that I can establish at this point would be that the two bacterial forms, bacterial-like forms, again, or let's call it, they would appear to be, let's say, at the ground floor equally at the beginning. It seems as though these set the stage for further growth and that they are the first to appear. And, you know, I'm introducing the topic of culturing. We'll do that some more as we go along. But this is how this has been learned, is to watch the growth of these forms and how they progress, and they do eventually culminate in that filament form. So the progression I see are the bacterial-like forms on pretty much equal footing, it appears, at the beginning stages. That middle stage, which hasn't actually been seen to form yet, it's only been seen after it forms, coming out of the... out of the filament. You know, that's not exactly true, because we do have some environmental samples that show it, or erythrocytes showing up from the very beginning. But in terms of trying to attach this to the structure, it certainly appears as though the erythrocytes are generally, and that's the same for the bacteria. You can have exceptions outside of the filament, but generally these things are encased or housed within the filament.
Let me ask you a question, please, Clifford. Now, the filament or fibers, which we've all talked about for many, many years, are you suggesting that you have observed and documented that the bacterial-like agent, a circular agent, which you are using the term, what are you using the term?
The bacterial-like, you mean?
Yeah, that one.
Uh-huh.
What does it look like most closely?
There's two types. One, the best match I can make is to chlamydia pneumonia, the most close, you know, closest match, again.
So it's a chlamydia pneumonia, that's what I would say. It's not.
Yeah, there's a sexual form of chlamydia.
Okay.
And then there's a chlamydia pneumonia, and chlamydia pneumonia is rather fascinating.
Okay.
Start looking into the symptoms of that and the life cycle of that. It's quite fascinating.
Okay, I wanted to make that differentiation. Thank you for that. Now, are we suggesting that the chlamydia pneumonia and the other forms, including the erythrocyte or the erythrocytic form, and the mycoplasma form, are all housed commonly, perhaps, within these fibers, and that they have been observed by you after you have sectioned or opened a fiber at any point in your research?
Yeah, this is not a suggestion. this is a pile of observations we have.
So you have seen these things come out of fibers in your work?
Yeah, I can see them inside of it.
I've seen the pictures. I'm doing this for the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. No. Yes, this is what has been documented in a very painstaking way. Is this progression over a period of years? You know, the individual components were seen individually. You know, that first EPA filament, I saw that circular structure. We can go way back to 2001. I have that, you know, submicron structure showing up. You know, and I start saying, "Hey, there's something here."
I remember.
But as we go along, yes, there's a comprehensive package here that has developed.
All right.
And I regard the filament as a housing or an encasing or a transport structure.
Now, one quick note, and I'm going to step out of the way. The filaments have been observed to move. Now, that would suggest that either the filament itself is capable of motion, some kind of sensory reaction to something, or the agents within it are causing it to move somehow. This is a very interesting and fascinating can of worms you've opened up here.
Yeah, there's plenty of worms, that's for sure. I mean, what I have done is I have recorded the growth of it under time-lapse photography.
Right.
I don't actually have access to, let's say, a continuous source of filaments. I just don't have that. This is only manifest in certain people. So I don't have that record. What I have done is direct my work towards being able to reproduce this in a culture in a controlled environment.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've done is film the growth of it, you know, that exterior casing. But yes, the progression to me is the bacterial-like forms, two of them, the third being an erythrocytic form, and the fourth being the encasing or housing structure. And that housing structure or an encasing filament, that thing is not easy to get into. That, you know, most people, I think that they view that filament as being the sort of the entity itself, but I view it just simply as a housing for what's going on inside.
Mm-hmm.
That material is very hard to get through. It appears to be of a proteinaceous nature, a keratin class, something like this, and very difficult to get into. And about, I don't know, whether it was a year and a half ago or so, a year ago, I found a way of breaking down that filament and basically revealing the internal components through the process, through the use of lye and heat. And if you look into the biochemistry books on basically how to break down a protein, that's exactly what you do. I discovered it after the fact. I found it by, let's call it accident or however we want to say it. And after I had done it, I had read in some biochemistry books, how would you go about breaking down a protein if you wanted to? And it's exactly what I did.
Most amazing.
It's subjecting it to strong alkalis and heat. And this was the method by which those filaments were opened up. This is the method by which the erythrocytic forms were seen emerging, essentially, from the filament. There's a picture that it shows a filament basically broken down, and you see the erythrocytic structures coming right out of the end of it.
Now, how close to the normal human erythrocyte are these erythrocytic structures?
In general, it's a perfect match. What happened here? Here's the variation. In its primary form, it appears to be of what I would call a desiccated nature. From the beginning, environmental samples and such, they were found. They were not the size of 6 to 8 microns as a human erythrocyte is. They were more in the order of 3 to 4 microns in their primary form. There, it was discovered that a process of reconstitution allows them to, let's call it, restore themselves to their full size. And there's different ways that that has been accomplished. The simplest would be that of a mildly saline solution. These things have been subjected to, you know, these filaments have been subjected to extreme heat and extreme cold, and nothing seems to destroy that.
Well, that would see that we have a break here, but that would, of course, go hand in hand with what we call mad cow disease. The protein form there is also heat resistant, up to, I think, 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that. So proteins are not easy to cut into at all, and Clifford's wizardry in getting into one is amazing, only exceeded by the astonishing things that are inside, apparently. These are the filaments. Be right back. Again, during all the years that Dr. Patricia Doyle and I have been covering mad cow disease and prions, the prions can withstand, and they are proteins, temperatures of at least 1,200 degrees, and Clifford has described a very expected and normal situation with respect to the protein-like substance of the fibers, which appear to be carriers or vessels. For what reason, I have no idea, and we don't know, but we're trying to find out, to bring at least three other primary items into the afflicted body, the erythrocytic object, the chlamydia pneumonia-like object, and the mycoplasma-like object. This is very strange, very, very strange. Go ahead, please, Clifford.
Yeah, Jeff, to answer your question, you know, do they match, human blood cells? Well, all I can say is to the best that I can do, yes, the reconstituted form of these erythrocytes match as close as anything that you can do, down to the, you know, sub half micron level or something like that, I would suppose.
All right. Well.
4 to 6 is, or 6 to 8 is exactly what they measure to be.
Right.
In addition to that, I mean, I have photographs of a human cell right next to it as a control. And, you know, a person can judge for themselves, but, see a duck, quack a duck. I mean, it's there best you can tell.
Right.
Now, there's another whole set of studies that were done I spent months on that in terms of this question of blood. Is it blood? There's a whole set of tests where, you know, I got to the level of, actually, there were three methods, two forensic tests, three total, though, but two forensic-level tests that identify hemoglobin within these. It's as far as I can go in making a match.
That's pretty darn scary.
Okay. So, you know, yes, the question is there a match? The best I can come up with from the absolute beginning there has been. Now, you know, as we go along tonight, it gets even a little bit crazier, and it's where sort of a couple of these latter papers have come from, of trying to get a bigger picture of what's actually happened here. And we'll get to that later tonight. But I suppose in terms of, you know, where we go from here, I wanted to give people a sense of, these are like four things. It's over and over and over. Mm-hmm. And for us to be, you know, focusing on just the filament and saying, you know, this is what we should be concerned about, I don't believe that's the case. We need to be looking at what is happening internal to this filament, because that is where the variation is occurring.
Or focusing on the filament and its appearance in the skin and lesions therein, and not understanding the quite logical conclusion that these filaments, fibers, have penetrated the entire organism and are simply manifesting themselves at the epidermal layer for whatever reason, we don't know, but they are certainly not exclusively found in the epidermis. We know that as well.
Absolutely the case. The skin is an excretory organ. It is what gets rid of things, waste products. And what is happening at the skin, again, to me, is a surface representation of what is going on here. And in terms of if people have a sense of these four things, you know, someday I'm going to have to make a page in where I just show these four things together in one page. They are all over the site, scores and scores of times.
Right.
But I probably don't have a single page where they're all shown in one place. I'm not sure that we'd have to look. I'm sure it's probably there as we dig into it. But what I wanted to mention then, if we have a sense of these four, my work increasingly over the last couple years or so has increasingly focused on the bacterial-like forms.
Mm-hmm.
The smallest entities, those that are hardest to sort of get a handle on, they have been my focus. And the reason is this, and it came about largely through the culture observations that I made. But these appear to be the genesis to me. This is the origination of this entity appears to me to be in these bacterial-like forms. And so this is where I have placed my attention increasingly over time. It is difficult to do this work because, first of all, you can't even see these things without having a scope, you know, at the 5 to 10K level, which, you know, we're just not going to have at the common level.
Right.
But increasingly, it's been important to me to go after that, and so that's what I've done. Now, in terms of these two or three papers, which whether we make them through it or not, as used, I don't know, but at least we'll summarize it. One of these was called A Mechanism of Blood Damage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you were talking about not just the skin, well, this is a great example. That bacterial-like form and even the pleomorphic form I'm talking about, they are found in the blood over and over and over, thus far, across the vast majority of the population that has been tested. Again, it's only a sample, but statistically, it says we've got a problem, a big problem.
Right.
Because this is showing up in the blood at a very high level on the statistical side. The truth is I haven't found an exception, an entire exception yet. But these bacteria-like forms are in the blood commonly. And it's actually pretty astounding and shocking at sometimes when you see how much is in there, when you actually can really see this.
Wow.
But it's in the blood. Now, there's a paper called Mechanism of Blood Damage.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some photographs of people. You know, that page is on the front page index there. And at some point, I'm not necessarily saying we should go over them tonight, but at some time, I would hope that people would look at these photographs because there was a discovery in this. When I hooked up a new camera, here's what happened in general. These things were seen in the blood, and we know the blood was damaged from it, but we had no idea how that happened. You know, where did that damage come from? How did these things get in the blood? With the camera that I was able to hook up here later, for the first time, you could basically see at least the mechanics of how this happened. And the answer is that these structures are in the surrounding plasma all the time, it looks like, and a lot of them, the number of them can be shocking, circulating in the surrounding fluid of the blood cells and the plasma. And because of the difference in the camera, just that slight difference in quality, I was able to see these structures external to the cells. First of all, remember, these things are measuring about a half a micron, so they're very small. But you saw these things basically congregate around the wall and the membrane of the cell. It's almost, one could say, that they appear to be attracted to it. In other words, these photographs will show you that this bacteriophorum, the early stage, first it's in the plasma. Second stage is that it sort of encircles the red blood cell and attaches itself to the wall. And then succeeding stages are that it starts to break down the wall and enter into the well and enter into the wall. And then the next stage would be the wall is completely broken up by basically a ring of these structures. So like the one I'm looking at here, there's probably 10 to 15 of these on the exterior of the wall. The wall has been broken down. Mm-hmm. And then in the extreme cases, the erythrocyte is completely riddled, let's say, on the interior of the cell with these structures. So for the first time, we could see how it was occurring. And it has to do with, to me, an attachment to the exterior of the cell wall, an attempt to break down that wall, and upon success, eventually destroy the integrity of that cell. It's really disastrous at that level at this point. And one of the defining stages here that I see in terms of effect on health appears to be whether or not it's able to get into those walls and break them down a lot. It does appear as though the structures themselves are freely within the plasma at all times, even if the blood cells look fine. And a normal blood test doesn't appear to me that it would be showing these things at all. And a person could have a blood cell examination and they could say, hey, it looks just fine. Because until you're getting down to the half micron level, direct observation, I don't know how you'd even pick it up. So that's what happens to these. And so, I regard that as one of the, let's say, critical indicators as to the degree of damage that's done here as to whether or not that blood cell has been broken down, whether that wall has been broken down or not. That's one paper. Another paper shows a live video, basically a live analysis of this, and that is what is that? That paper. It's a long title, but the paper ends with the word "live analysis." It's actually called pH conductivity ions and live analysis.
Right. You can see all these right on the homepage at carnicom.com. Just click on Clifford's name, or just remember CARNICOM carnicom.com. All the papers are right there. Go ahead.
And that live analysis page is rather fascinating because it captures on video, really at the same level. I think I have that. Yeah, I have that at the same thing, 10,000 on those. And it's really quite amazing because here what you learn in video is you learn that these bacterial-like forms, they are motile, okay? They move, okay? And you can see them move in this video. I'm looking at this now, and, you'll see one. It actually appears to be inside the cell, but as I've looked at this, these cells are really quite transparent at this magnification, and it can actually even be underneath a cell and look like it's in it. But you can freely see these things moving in the plasma around the cell, and it's really quite remarkable because, if someone starts to ask, hey, is something alive here? Well, there's motion, I'll say that. It would certainly, my focus on this has been biology. We've had a lot of folks talk about robots and this type of thing, and maybe so, but I go by direct observation, and I see things of what I would call engineered forms of life, and we'll get to that a little bit more later on. But there's dead serious biology going on here as far as I can see, and I'm not going to say that it doesn't have some level of artificial mechanization at some point, but let's just say I don't have any direct observation of it, and there's enough here to keep us busy without getting into speculative robotic things without
right.
The proof of it.
Coming up on a break here in just a few minutes, talking with Clifford Carnicom about his research into Morgellons and some of the astonishing things he has found. The overall suggestion here is that this appears to be potentially within the realm of human creation, given an evil and psychopathic enough brain and enough laboratory equipment and expertise. But we'll get to conclusions later on. This is a very, very big story. And we're very honored to have Clifford with us tonight. Back in just a few minutes.